Yeah, this race was really difficult to manage. You know, the first laps it was raining a little bit, but I wasn't sure how much to push. Anyway, I was taking some big advantages on everybody else, so I was happy just to continue like this. Bike felt good. Everything was working so well for most of the race. You know, it would rain a little bit and then stop, so I would lose some time to the others and then take time back. And I was happy in this position, but then at the end of the race, the rain started to come down too much, and I didn't really want to crash in the last race, so I took some less risk, I think, than the others, and didn't feel so comfortable than the others in this condition. Then I made a small mistake when they were catching me. Before the back straight, I take the neutral. And then Ben came past, and I decided to stay behind him. You know, it was nice to have somebody in front to understand the conditions. And I pretty much just stayed with Ben until the last lap. And in the last lap, I took a lot more risks than I did through all this season. And I tried everything to catch him in the last three, four corners. And this was enough to give me the speed onto the straight to win. And, you know, it was really a fantastic race for us.
The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 298. Wednesday, the 9th of October, 2011. My name is Jules Cisek, and I'm with Jim Race. How are you, Jim?
I'm good as ever, as Martin would say. and it's good to talk to you again. We're edging up towards our 300th show. We might talk about that later, but good to be back on.
Yes.
Although, you know what, Jules? This is kind of that poignant moment in the year where, you know, the last race is done. We've had some testing. We still have, you know, we'll certainly talk about this shortly, but, you know, a little bit of silly season still going on, postseason. But this is that kind of year where you're like, ah.
Now what?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we've got Macau coming up, and you promised Mark Miller last
episode. I did.
In
fact, just before... you and I hopped on the call here on Wednesday evening. I was emailing back and forth with Mark because Mark is actually flying out this weekend. And so we're trying to figure out a time to do it perhaps before and once he actually arrives in China. So I'm working on that. And I know you're working on an interview as well. So certainly not that we're not going to have more stuff. And I seem to have a very interesting potential grasp on some nice internet connectivity for not necessarily from home, but as an alternative going forward. So I'm stoked about that. And that should be able to make for maybe perhaps some late night interviews too, for me at least.
By 2012, you're going to be back in the 21st century?
No, I'm shooting for 2020 actually. All right. But the goal certainly is to be hooked up and you know, it really over the winter holidays is kind of an opportunity for me, and it always has been, to get a chance to talk to some of these guys anyway when they're, you know, chilling out and figuring things out. So
yeah, look, definitely gonna be cool.
Yeah,
and speaking of interviews that may or may not happen, unfortunately, Martin was not able to talk to James Whittam over the weekend due to inclement weather, as the pilots like to say, which is probably means that they just didn't feel like leaving home. But the questions you guys sent in were excellent. We were compiling them, and Martin will get to talk to James possibly at the end of this month, but definitely before the end of the year. So keep them coming. There's some really, really good ones, actually.
There are. And certainly you guys have gotten with the spirit of the calls that we've and the talks we've had with James, knowing that James certainly has a good sense of humor, and some of your questions have been quite humorous. So,
yeah, exactly.
I'm looking forward to those, and we'll have to see how embarrassed Martin gets. You know, certainly I'm not one to get embarrassed, but you know, Martin has that proper English dialect, and if he can step up and ask the hard questions, right?
I am not worried at all. Does that have to do it? All right. Listener feedback. So we had a lot of email again. One actually came before last show, but it was after Jim and I had done a call already, so we weren't able to put this in. But this one's from Paul Pacey. We've heard from him obviously several times before. And he wrote up, he just recently watched the TT3D movie and wanted to write in asking, you know, if we have some like off season kind of ideas. And if, I don't know, was it last year or the year before we did the motorcycle movie episode? Remember that?
Yeah, I think so too.
We need to bring that thing back because there's been some things to be added to that list. I think so. And it's worth going through that again.
Sure.
Anyway, here's Paul's review. Guy Martin, holy crap, he is so funny. It was a struggle for the first few sentences to understand him, but after getting used to the accent, it was just a riot. No bullshit whatsoever exists in this man. I love it. I can see why Jim fell in love with this event. After seeing this documentary, I really want to go get along to the TT one day. I think I'll have to talk the wife into a European getaway, then flee at the airport to take in the TT, some MotoGP and Superbike events, and she can entertain herself with the bronze-skinned Mediterranean types. The 3D wasn't too distracting. It was pretty cool in some places. Overall, the photography was great, and some of the shots made you hold your breath. The narrative starting a few weeks before the TT and watching the build-up and preparations was cool, but then the race action was so good. I'm about to see Fastest next weekend here in Australia. We only get 1 week to watch it. I've got best man duties at a wedding, blah, blah, blah. That's personal stuff. There is no way I'm going to miss it. I only hope it is as good as TT3D was. But he was a bit disappointed that there were only two or three quick sound bites from Mark Miller. I think they didn't want to distract from Guy Martin as being comedian number one.
they don't know the true potential of Mark Miller, apparently.
Yeah, not yet. So I have not seen TT3D. The DVD is still not released in the region one, as far as I know.
No. And when I was at the island, I didn't have, or I had sort of pseudo had the opportunity to see it. It was playing there, but timing wise,
you were at the TT.
Yeah.
So you had better things to do.
Yes. No, I actually had it in 4D. I was kind of bummed that I didn't, and I'd been hoping to perhaps bring home a review copy for us, but never pulled that together. Let me see if I can't finagle that for us, Jules, over the winter holiday maybe, and see if we can't put in our own two pence on it.
And speaking of Faster is being released on DVD in the United States and Canada on November 15th. If you haven't ordered your copy yet, just go to Fastest. Did I say Faster? I meant Fastest. Just go to Fastest Movie. We'll have that, of course, in the show notes.
Yep. And of course, to that we say.
Next email is from Sam Dixon. And he said, I've got an interesting, I hope, point to throw out there. Do you think Max Biaggi missed his era in MotoGP by a few years? By that, I mean his skills and tendencies seem to fit the 250s. Wheels in line style of the 800s. I would imagine Biaggi in his prime on an 800 may have been a force. I don't know. What do you guys think? I totally agree. I think that he probably is looking back and going, oh, dang. I mean, in 2007, Max Biaggi would have been 35 years old. So a bit over the hill at that point for all the young guys coming in. But, you know, He may have been an interesting force in that year. I don't think he would have been able to beat Stoner, but it would have been interesting to see. And certainly, if he had been younger when the 800s came around, I think he would have been a massive force. Because it's very true. He's the only thing that's missing from Biaggi's arsenal for being the perfect 800 rider is that he's not that. He tends to make mistakes. We've all seen him do that, you know, going wide bit. I mean, it's so to the point where you kind of expect that whenever he passes somebody, he's going to have to go wide. And so he doesn't have the same precision that Jorge Lorenzo has, for example. And he doesn't have that kind of, you know, lay everything on the line throttle control that Casey Stoner has. But I think he would have been very well suited for the 800s, much more so than the 990s even.
I disagree.
You do?
I do.
Okay.
I don't think that were Max to be racing the 800s in his prime, that he would have the temperament not only to deal with the changed paddock, the changed temperament of the paddock, but also the temperament that was required of the 800s, because it required such a precise style, and he bless his heart, now he's, you know, the nicest guy in the world. Well, maybe not, but he, especially for Marco Melandri, but he had a big tendency to blame the bike and the team when he wasn't getting along with the bike. And I think the 800s, if anything, were tougher to ride than the 990s. And so I'm not sure how well
he would've... But it's not the difficulty, I think. It's more about, I mean, he's...
Remember,
he's overcome those issues in the past as well. It's just, you know, yes, when things fall apart for him, he tends to point fingers. But I don't think that would... I'm just talking about his skill set. I agree that his personal temperament would probably mean that him and Stoner would probably actually been punching each other, given that Piaggio does like to follow people out on the track. We know that. and Stoner does not. And they both get punchy, literally. And so that would have been interesting. But no, I mean, I see what you're saying, but that's too many what ifs. We're just talking about just pure, like, on the track riding style.
Oh, fine. Well, I didn't. Next time, please let me know if there's a limit to what I can.
Nice, nice. No, I mean, your point is very well taken. Very well taken. All right. Ed Hazer wrote in and said, the problem I see with Suzuki running the 800 amidst the 1000s next year, if that's what happens, is that this the same that the Roberts three-cylinder Proton had. They could run really fast lap times with a clear track because of their high corner speed, but when in traffic, the other bikes with their different lines would not allow that to happen. And that's a really interesting point. So what I was saying is basically that even on the faster tracks, you know, because Valencia, for example, where we had the tests, is not a very good test of what 1,000 versus 800 would be like, since it's a fairly tight track where an 800 might actually have a chance. But even on the faster tracks, if you ride the 800 the way, you know, these guys have been riding, they could probably compete pretty well on the lap times if they were just circulating on their own. But in a race situation, it's kind of like, whenever I think of like really different lines, I'm always thinking about Turkey back in, like, I don't know, 2006.
Sure.
Maybe 2007, when Tony Elias and Valentino Rossi got tangled up. You remember this?
Oh, absolutely.
Because Elias had completely different lines, and it just didn't work, you know?
Well, it worked for Tony.
It worked for him. Exactly. It worked for him. So I think it's an interesting point that Ed is making, and we'll get into more about that when we talk about testing.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, if you go back to that race, that's the only race Tony Elias ever won. And
No. That's Tony Elias won in Estoril. This was
right. Estoril.
He took second place.
Right. But okay. And you're right. But I do remember, especially through turns one and two, the left right combo at Istanbul, he was giving Rossi fits, fits. Yeah.
To the point where Rossi was complaining about it afterwards, which is kind of ironic.
Well, that was back when Tony made everybody's jaws drop. So,
yeah.
And back when he actually had tires that he could pull that shit off on. So
exactly, exactly. Right. Yeah. And finally, Rose Runner, who's been writing in pretty much regularly lately, and thank you very much for that, writes, the first thing I heard from Espoleta was that CRT bikes were being created so he could have a championship even if all the factories pulled out. It's happened before. Agostini's win total is so large in part because he rode the only factory bike on the grid from 1969 to 1973. Factories race to sell bikes. Race teams race because that's what they exist for. Espoleta is making a way for race teams to run in MotoGP. Every race this year has seen greater than 3 seconds from the front of the grid to the back guys. Given that world superbikes are within 3 seconds at every track, they share in common. It seems like a hopped-up superbike in a full race chassis with carbon brakes ought to do okay. I like there's a bunch of points here. You know, we're actually used to, for the last decade, having the racing be about the factories. And well, not as much about the race teams. It's an interesting point.
I guess part of it is I can still remember when it wasn't all about the factories, and you know part of it is just timing. How long have you been watching, and how well you can actually extrapolate what you can see? I mean, I can look at World Superbike with quote unquote factory teams and how, to be honest, how that's vacillated over the years.
But yeah.
The factories have not always championed there. Or at least, the upstarts or the satellite teams or the just, customer bike teams have done well. What will CRTs do in 2012? I don't know, but if there's one thing I do know, there's no way we can gauge it from what we saw over the last couple of days, Jules, because, some of the bikes that were on the grid over these last couple of days were the first time they've been seen in public. Certainly.
Yeah. And with riders who don't compete with these guys. We'll talk more about that a little later when we go over the test, but CRT performance is the big unknown, obviously. Right.
Yeah.
But the setup here is the interesting one, right? Where the power is starting to shift more towards the ERDA side, basically, which is the representation of the race teams.
Sure.
And that's not because Dorna goes, oh, I want to coddle, ERDA instead of the SMA. It's because the hope is that the entertainment is going to be better.
Well, I think the other hope, or not even hope, is that for, the last N number of years, maybe that decade that you were talking about, the MSMA has been calling the shots, in what they claim is an effort to produce good racing and also reduce the budget has driven both of them kind of into the shitter. So, it's time.
I don't think anybody saved any money.
I don't think so either. I mean, if they had, we wouldn't have, 16 bikes on the grid right now.
Yeah. Or less after the first corner. Okay. So thank you, everybody, for writing in. Keep the emails coming. Motopod@motopodcast.com. Martin put one note in this week for us, which was, of course, about the MCN Fantasy road race result, because it's now done. And he just wanted to rub it into our faces that he finished 11th in the Motopod League, 827th overall, which is quite a bit higher than myself, Jim, and Gonzalo. But we did want to mention the guys who actually did take the first, second, and third spots in our Motopod League. And that's Barry Hellier with Team Orvis All-Stars, Adam Mercado, with Team Blackheart, and Vittorio Tomolillo, who was pretty much up at the top three the entire season, it seemed like.
Sure.
With Team Ratsars. And then we also had the tipping on the competition on Ride On 2 finished with Scott Bolton, a.k.a. MotoDog 650, winning the championship. And it was really, really tight. Tight battle with, I think, like the top 15 competitors finishing within the 7 points. That's the maximum that you can get during a round. So it's pretty amazing.
What was the what was the winner's point total?
56.
56?
Yep.
That's still way low. I'm surprised
I know, because you think that, you know, everybody would just pick Stoner the whole time, but there were surprises this season, so I think a lot of people kind of got caught out on the point side.
Yeah. You know what we need to figure out over there, and my apologies to those of you that frequent that forum, I just haven't been over there hardly at all lately, is that we've never had a way of capturing the results from the prior years. Those just
I'm working on it, dude.
Okay.
I've got it's all in the data. It's all in the database. I just need to, you know, write the right script.
Okay.
And we're also going to change the rules for next year, because after Sepang and Marco Simoncelli's fatality there, I just don't want to see DNF, first DNF anymore, you know?
Sure.
So we'll figure out a new set of rules for that. Like maybe, you know, first place, podium and pole position or something like that.
Okay.
So anyway, we had the final weekend in Valencia, and it was surprising on many fronts. So I think one of the most surprising things was that the 125 and Moto2 races that we were looking forward to were kind of boring, and it was the MotoGP race that was really amazing. But you know, each one of them had their own, obviously, drama.
True. I did not get the opportunity yet to watch the 125s, but I caught the Moto2 race tonight. And obviously weather was a factor throughout all of Sunday, and it figured into each race just a little bit differently.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, the weather sucked, basically, the entire time. Because Saturday was bad, too. We had, I think, dry. It was really only dry on Friday. For the 125s, the interesting thing was that, you know, as we know, Johann Zarco had to finish the race in first, and Nicolas Tirol had to finish 10th or higher to win the world championship. If he finished below that, he would not. And after qualifying, Johann Zarco was on the front row, and Nicolas Tirol was on the back of the third row in ninth. So that actually was looking pretty interesting. Now, pole position in 125s was Danny Webb. It was this strange, semi-wet, mostly wet. A lot of the riders actually came out on wets, went back in, got slicks on again. And Danny Webb, Louis Rossi, who was second, Louis Salom, who was fourth, Alexei Masbau, and I believe Hector Fabel, all were on slicks, and Johann Zarco, who was third, switched to wets, and then kept getting pushed further and further back in the standings. But I don't know how he managed that third position time on the wets. But well, if you look at the gaps, is when you go, oh, I see, because Danny Webb and Louis Rossi were about half a second from each other, but then Zarco was 2.1 seconds back from Danny Webb. And everybody else just... Then it got tight. But nevertheless, Zarco was on wets, and the next three or four guys were still on slicks. So that's pretty impressive for Zarco to be able to do that, because it never really got wet enough. He was gambling that it was going to really come down.
If you remember the term that was used often this weekend... by commentators and racers alike, they said, and I thought this was kind of ironic, because it certainly was true, both figuratively and literally, it was going to be an upside down weekend.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And it really was.
Yep.
In so many ways. So it looked like, you know, on paper, it looked like it was going to be very interesting for the championship, but to be honest, you have to look at this and say, well, there's no way, no offense to these riders that finished ahead of Tirol, but Alexei Masbau, I don't think that he's going to be fifth for the race. You know, Danny Webb, I don't think he's going to be up there. I don't think he's going to be a problem. I don't think Luis Rossi is going to be a problem. It's, you know, Zarco, Fabel, Cortese, Vinales. Yeah. But that's five guys, you know. So it was looking pretty good for Tirol for the race. And, you know, it could have been interesting. But unfortunately, Zarco didn't have the best of starts. I think he was fifth by the end of the first lap, and then crashed on lap three. So that was the end of the championship right there. The race was eventually won by Maverick Vinales, who also took Rookie of the Year easily. I think he has the Rookie of the records, three or four of them.
Certainly.
I think he was like the third most awarded guy at the MotoGP, you know, end of the season awards ceremony. He's just constantly picking stuff up for various prizes.
Not only that, but according to Paris Hilton, he won the MotoGP finals.
That's right. Thank you. So final standings and, the final race results were Vinales, Tirol in second, so obviously easily got these points, and Fabel on the podium, Efren Vasquez, Folger, and Alberto Moncayo in sixth. And it was very processional race after a while. It was we had the front guys kind of spread out after 10 laps. So, very upside down, like you said, you know, because sure. We always see good 125 racing at Valencia. So it was kind of a bummer. You know, I think the eighth place was 52 seconds behind the leader. It was just all over the place.
Weather again. Right.
So Moto2. Moto2 was weird because by the time we got to qualifying, about 5 minutes into qualifying, it was obvious that Marc Marquez was not going to even go out, which means he would not be able to qualify, which meant that officially Stefan Bradl became the world champion during the qualifying session on Saturday.
But you know, I want to pause us here for a moment because
sure,
at least to me. And everything that I had read up to, frankly, even just through Wednesday prior, it was pretty clear that the guy wasn't going to be able to race. And everything else was just, you know, like wishful thinking on his part. And, you know, the people that ruled him out then, the odds were incredibly long that there was any chance that he was actually going to get to race. It was essentially going to be a miracle if he had the opportunity to do so. So that's just my preface to, as we wander into this here.
Yeah, of course. In a way it was kind of nice because it spread out the championship celebrations throughout the weekend, you know, because there was still Tirol was crowned on Sunday.
Right.
But definitely felt like Moto2 was building up to be the most amazing finale, and it just fizzled after Sepang because of Marquez's injuries, and it was real letdown. I mean, you know, that's part of racing, right? It's like, are we supposed to always be, you know, is the script perfect? No, of course not.
Well, you know, I also have to wonder if it didn't start prior to that at Phillip Island. With the accident that he had with Willerat, because he certainly got banged up there. He got banged up there. He got banged up bad a week later at Malaysia in the non-flagged wet corner. And so, you know, it's that kind of stuff, you know, kind of not only that, but if you think about it, well, I mean, the way the race turned out, there's a whole bunch of what ifs, you know, at that point, right, Jules?
Let me give you this what if. If we had come into this weekend and Bradl was only 10 points ahead of Marquez?
Well, if you know, the dude was wearing an eye patch, like, you know, half an hour before.
No. By Tuesday, the eye patch was off, and he was saying that it was amazing the progress that he was making.
I saw an eye patch photo taken Friday.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe he didn't have the 10 points. I'm just saying that in the past, we've had people hide injuries and all sorts of stuff to be able to go out there, race or any sport, right? Athletes are there to compete. And I have a feeling that if Marquez felt that he had a bigger chance, he's the kind of guy that would be like, I'm fine. Yeah, let's go.
Well, I think part of that was my point in talking about, you know, PI possibly being a starting point, because the Clinica Mobile people are going to be looking at him for weeks and weeks at that point, you know, a month.
Much more carefully, you mean?
Yeah. And so, you know, I don't know, maybe Friday was National Talk Like a Pirate Day in Spain and I just got confused, but... either way, you know, it's not like Marquez went back home to his hometown in Spain, got a hero's welcome. He certainly is, you know, it's not the end of his career. And, in a way, the what if, Jules, almost increases the excitement for next year. Now, are we 100% sure? Well, let's not go there yet.
We'll get there in a sec. But whatever happens, whoever is in Moto2, Marquez will make it exciting.
Indeed. You know,
whoever he's up against.
Yeah.
And I'm really looking forward to the next season. And, you know, I hope that nobody puts an asterisk next to Brattle's championship. Like, for years, it seemed like Nicky Hayden was getting it. It's like it took a long time for people to just let it go. You know, guess what? Nicky Hayden won. I actually came up with a couple of interesting stats just to put things in perspective, because you have to keep in mind that Marquez won more races than Brattle, right? Because Brattle had a really terrible start to the second half of the season, and he had a really bad race in Aragon. But we also have to remember that at Indy, he started 22nd and finished 6th, which is similar to what happened to Marquez at PI, except that Marquez was doing fine at PI. He was just penalized, whereas Stefan Bradl had a shitty weekend the entire time at Indy, and somehow he pulled off a miracle on Sunday. So, and then the other thing is that if you take this is a stat that I pulled off of MotoGP.com. You take the full distance that they raced up until Phillip Island. I think it's like 1,600 kilometers for Stefan Bradl, and it's 1,400 and change kilometers for Marquez. This is at the end of Phillip Island, so before the Sepang incident, before Marquez got really hurt. And that's because Marquez was crashing early on. Now, if you take that and you compare it to the number of laps that they led during races, Stefan Bradl led like 145 laps and up until that point, and Marquez led 96, I think.
Okay.
So, if you take those as ratios, Stefan Bradl led more of his kilometers than Marquez. You know, and it doesn't matter because it's the guy who crosses the line. I mean, if there's a rider who loves to just follow and win, you know, win at the line, like for example, Tirol did last year or tried to, it doesn't really mean anything. But I just wanted to point out that Stefan Bradl isn't some lucky guy who, like, you know, it wasn't just consistency. The guy was really on the sharp end for a big part of the season, and. You know, they each had 7 poles, and Stefan Bradl, very deserving champion, and we'll talk about him a little later on the show, has got some skills. That boy has got skills.
No doubt.
So congratulations to him. Race-wise, you know, again, the great thing about the race was that we had Michelle Pirot and Yuki Takahashi from Gresini on pole in second, with Mika Kallio in third. Seven Brattle qualified fourth, De Angelis fifth, and Thomas Luthi sixth. So that already looked very like an interesting race. But obviously Gresini, you know, wasn't even sure if they were going to be racing this weekend. To have them, those two guys on the front row was awesome. And during the race, of course, unfortunately, Takahashi had a nasty high side on lap, believe was lap six.
Six. For whatever reason, I thought it was four before, but we'd be remiss to not point out that the weather changed quite a bit from 125s, which kind of was just a steady, you know, drizzle down, to intermittent at various corners between decent rain and mild. So once again, the guys had no idea what they're going to encounter from lap to lap, and that certainly played in. On top of that, it seemed like the lines, the painted lines, especially the white lines at the end of the straights at Valencia, were the culprit. Not in everything, mind you.
Right.
The high sides, that was usually front end washes that were taking those out. But
right.
There were a bunch of places that the guys simply, it seemed like they had no idea what they were about to hit. In fact, your point is well taken, because most of the crashes in Moto 2 were high sides, if these little squiggly spit-offs. But
right. Yeah, and Takahashi was a nasty, nasty tumble. I, as far as I know, he's mostly fine, so it's good news.
Right, but he certainly looked like a rag doll through the gravel.
Oh
track.
Man, oof, that was brutal. It was brutal. But then from that point on, from lap six, we had Michelle Pirot leading all the way to the end. And, you know, very emotional, obviously. Not a super exciting race. He won by 6 seconds and was managing that gap for most of the race, actually. But it's his first victory, I believe, right? Yeah. And a very emotional one for Gresini. We have to go back to 2003, when the same squad, Gresini, was also unfortunately involved with the fatality of Kato. That was he was Sete Gibernau's teammate, and at the next race, you know, at Velcom, Sete Gibernau won that race, and it's kind of wild. I mean, you know, to have to go through that, the team having to go through that kind of pain twice, and then that kind of joy in a way twice. Crazy emotions. Fausto Gresini on the wall, you know,
sure,
cheering Michelle Pirot on as he crossed the finish line, you know, in tears. So very emotional moments. Kallio and Agutter had a fantastic battle for second, which Kallio won. But they were fighting it out for the last five or six laps. You know, it was a knife fight. It was a total knife fight.
Right.
And Agutter, this is his first podium, and he got a haircut in Parc Fermé. I guess he had some kind of agreement with his crew that if he gets on the podium, the ponytail goes. So the ponytail and a part of his mullet went as well. So, yeah.
You know, you did kind of forget the biggest what-if story of the race.
Well, Stefan Bradl, yes. Bradl fell. On the same lap that's right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It was the same lap that Takahashi had his high side.
Yeah.
And it was a very innocuous-looking kind of fall. He was one of the few guys that didn't high side out of the fallers. And he kind of went through the gravel and looked like he just kind of just got stuck there. And but he couldn't get it started again. Kind of a shame and a bummer for him to finish the his world championship season this way, but you know, shit happens. And God, yeah, what if? I mean, if Marquez was out there and healthy and could have won that race, wouldn't that have been crazy?
Yeah, I mean, well, actually, let me see, Brattle was 23 ahead heading into that. So
So if Marquez would have had to win,
yeah.
But
that'd be hard to do with an eye patch in the rain.
If he was 100% healthy, it would have been a crazy way to finish the season.
You know,
that's not what happened.
I have to think if he had a telepathic parrot on his shoulder.
Okay. Anthony West was fourth. Obviously. He's the guy who hates to be called the rain guy, but it was his kind of conditions. Kenny Noyes was fifth, dude.
Yeah, and he had a good little punch up with Noyes there for a bit too.
Yeah. And Hernandez. I mean, those guys stuck together. It was good to see that Kenny, you know, this is, I guess, is kind of his home track in a way, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of. He had crap results most of the season, so it was good to see him finishing on a high note. I know that Dennis was very tweety about it. anything else about Moto 2? Also, again, congrats to Stefan Bradl. But dude, he needs a better wardrobe for the ceremony afterwards.
Yeah, it was kind of weird, and I agreed with Toby and Jules when, you know, there was like a lap and a half or two laps left and he was wandering down through the hot pit in his championship gear while the race was still going on. I'm like, okay, that's a weird little thing. I thought that was kind of odd. I mean, I understand it's some, not the kind of thing that comes in your head when you're doing, you're trying to get, you know, kind of ahead of the crowds before they get down there. Yeah. But that was weird. That kind of struck me as an oddity. So
yeah, well, he's German. Okay. let's see. So, MotoGP.
Yep.
Which turned out to be the most interesting race of the weekend. But man, qualifying, jaw dropping. Casey Stoner was up by a second. He took pole by a second over Danny Pedrosa, with Ben Spies in third, Randy Depugne in fourth, which is the best qualifying position for Randy all year. Wasn't that the best Ducati position qualifying all year?
No, I want to say.
I think Hayden was fourth before.
Why do I want to say Barbera had a fourth? I don't know.
Well,
I don't know. Anyway, it was a great qualifying, especially for Randy, considering the difficulties he's had this season, and you know, still kind of a question mark going into the end of the year as well, too. So
yeah. I think he's the last question mark, really.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, Bautista and Valentino Rossi on the second row. So it just looked like, I mean, this Stoner was on top of every session except warm up.
Yeah,
when Josh Hayes, who's, you know, riding obviously for Colin Edwards this at Valencia, was fastest. Apparently, I guess he went out on slicks, right? What, the rest of them were out on wets.
He was the only guy out on slicks.
Crazy, but steel brakes.
Yeah,
not carbon.
That was a classic sign of what the weather was like over the weekend, which was you know, on again, off again, and actually choosing your tires must have been crazy. And Josh, bless his heart, but he probably went with whatever the team pointed out for him. Right. And maybe they were gambling, you know, it was going to be a full dry race, you know, as it was MotoGP, all the guys did go off on slicks. And so that may well have not only given him a confidence boost, certainly, and a little bit of a, well done. I like what he said right after that. He said, I should have packed up and gone home.
Yeah, we retire on a high note.
Yeah, retire on a high note. Well, as it turned out, he still had more to give. But
oh yeah, I know exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, yeah,
he didn't qualify well because he qualified last. But mm-hmm. So he was starting for the back row. Yeah. But that's important to note because obviously that things changed very quickly in that race.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we? Let's see. Is there anything else worth discussing from? Did we mention how ridiculously fast Stoner was? And how incredibly cool he was to watch. You know, he is the perfect guy for all of Phillip Island, to watch him on Phillip Island, especially going through the Southern Loop and stuff.
Right.
And in Valencia, there's not that much, you know, but that last corner was made for Casey Stoner.
Sure.
You know, I mean, the shots of him going out there drifting at the back end effortlessly and just, oh man, it was beautiful, beautiful to watch.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, it was, I think that actually played into the race too. But the race, the biggest, I guess, disappointment of the race was what happened at T1 on the first lap, like just after the start.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, we had Bautista also with a great qualifying position, and certainly he's been coming on as the season has moved on. There were a lot of guys, Rossi up there, feeling that he not only could get and wanted to get certainly a decent finish, you know, on the box, if not better. So you had a lot of guys who were hungry for the front, Jules. And
because the weather was, I mean, the race was actually declared wet. So they could have gone out on wets. They could have stayed on slicks, and the bikes were ready for swapping. So sure. We know from various practices this year that the Ducatis were much better matched up when in the wet,
no doubt,
or like this kind of like coldish, because it was pretty cold too. Let's see, what was the temperatures? Yeah, ground temperature was 16 degrees Celsius, less than air for once, it really told you that it never got warm during the day, which meant that the track stayed cool.
Sure. But as it turned out, everybody went off on slicks.
Yep.
There were a few variances in what people were using for the fronts, being at the medium or the medium hard. And that may have put... Yeah, as it turned out, that may or may not have played a role as the race went on. But as Jules mentioned before, and everybody knows if you've seen the race, we had a what you can only term as a pileup in turn one, and it basically happened when Alberto and got a little bit tight on Dubby going into one, and the two of them essentially tried to occupy the same space at the same time. That brought...
Wait. Alberto?
Yes.
You mean Alvaro?
Oh, I'm sorry, Alvaro.
I was like, was Puig out there?
Yeah.
Pushing Dovey around?
He was directing traffic. He had a stake in that too, didn't he? Down goes Bautista. I'll just use that instead. On the inside of the corner, the worst place you can do it, going into the first turn. And
yeah, because you're sliding and collecting people along the way.
Indeed. And he swept or broomed, as they say, a large portion of the mid-front pack. As we well know, first getting into Rossi, or I'm sorry, I guess he got into Rossi first, Hayden next, and then finally Ben Spies on the outside. And
Depunier.
Or I'm sorry, Depunier.
Yeah.
I'm heading back to the prior race, aren't I? Clearly I'm getting a little bit tired tonight. It was just a mess. And it was a real bummer because those were all guys that had the opportunity to run at the front this race.
Yeah, I think Rossi could have done a good job, but the guy that really, I think, it was painful to see him go out of the race was Depunier, because Depunier has had a really tough season with the duck. And he looked, and he's the one guy who, as we'll talk later, has not. We don't know what's going on with him next year. There's a little bit of news, but we really have no idea what's going to happen. And Hayden actually got hurt. He broke his scaphoid in his right hand, which sucks because he wasn't able to participate in the test. And scaphoid injuries are can dwell for a long time.
Yeah,
especially because he's so old now. He's like 30.
Yeah, and if I remember what the description was, it was a spiral, which
The worst. Yeah. They can't even actually set it. They just basically said, you know, stay off it.
But yeah.
Yeah, and it was so Stoner took off, Pedrosa and Dovey and then later Spies, they had a really great battle behind Stoner, but Stoner was gone. And we thought basically, okay, fine, Stoner, you know, 10 seconds, 12 seconds, whatever. I think maximum was 10 seconds. He's gone. You know, once in a while they'll show him drifting through the final corner. But the battle between Pedrosa and Dovey was critical because they're still fighting for the third spot in the championship.
Well, they're also fighting for a bit of pride, frankly, for Dovey.
And I think much more than that. I was just going to say much more than that, the pride for Dovey because he's leaving. So Dovey did end up taking Pedrosa. And Pedrosa has had kind of a reputation for being not so good in the wet. And that's a lot of explanations for his performance in this race were kind of put to that, but I seem to remember that kind of went away. You know, he actually turned out to be pretty damn good in the wet a few times. I don't really know what happened to Pedrosa, but he started drifting back. Then it became a battle between Spies and Dovey, and you know, all of a sudden. The timing, I don't know if you were watching the timing. I was watching the timing during the race, and all of a sudden I noticed, wait a second, they're totally catching Stoner.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought that must be something massively wrong with Stoner's bike, but it turned out that it was basically just, it got wetter out there. There were places where there was sprinkling, and it got dangerous, and he didn't feel comfortable. When you're out front all by yourself, it's very difficult to set the pace, so... He decided to kind of take it a little easier, but the Spies and Dovizioso caught up, and Spies actually took lead for two laps, but unfortunately, on the last lap, last corner, the only explanation I have for this is that I don't think that Stoner was playing him. I think basically Stoner took a big risk, and that's actually what Stoner said. I believe he said that he just decided to take a really big risk on that last lap to catch Ben, because Ben was pulling away. Ben was up like 2 seconds at one point on the last lap, but Stoner caught him, and in that last corner took the perfect line out of there and got a better drive and beat Ben to the finish line by, what, 15 thousandths, right? 15 thousandths per second, yeah.
Yep. Well, it, at least from what I saw, and there's been plenty of speculation on this online, of course, but... it was clear that Ben got up on the exit corner of the final turn pretty far, and it was a great overhead shot because you could actually see the velocity between the two of them changing. It was clear, like you said, that Casey got a great drive out of the last corner, but when Ben got up on that curb, and he was well in the middle of it, when he came off the curb, he came off onto one of the service roads. And as soon as he dropped down on there, you could tell that his speed was way down on Casey. And that was when the overtake really started picking up. And my guess is, you know, it's a combination, not only the way that the Honda gets out of the corner, but odds are that Ben got up on that paint and the rumble strips, of course, that you've got there, and just probably massively lost traction.
Yeah.
You know, the thing spun up. And or it was just bouncing off of there and not getting any grip when it was doing its bouncing. But as soon as he hit the service road, it was almost like he had the brakes on. I mean, it was that much of a speed reduction. And that was kind of when you knew that all Casey had to do was, you know, go Yeah, and Casey certainly did stretch the fly-by-wire throttle cables. He stretched the wire.
He stretched
the electrons, but yeah, it was a great finish and fun to watch.
It's really a shame that Ben didn't get that win, but because it would have just been the biggest surprise of the weekend, I think, at that point, especially after how Casey was dominating.
Yeah, you know, I almost think that it still was the biggest surprise of the weekend, frankly, because given how he'd come into this weekend, you know, not riding in Malaysia, having his difficulties in PI, it was a hell of a run because he didn't, you know, it really didn't look that great up until that point. And certainly in the early portions of the race, we thought Casey was gone. And even when the rain was picking up a little bit, you never, like you said, you were watching timing and scoring, never expected it. Well, I didn't catch timing and scoring live, but I was listening to Toby and Julie, and they gave the best timing and scoring information as far as screaming. Yeah. The screaming and yelling went. They were astounded, but both of them, of course, were calling the race for Stoner early. You know, four laps in. And it just goes to show how quickly something can turn around.
Well, we almost had the same thing at PI. Remember when the rain fell, the last lap, people were crashing and positions started changing and people were getting caught. So, yeah, I mean, obviously that's the traction changes and, you know, some people are comfortable with it. Some bikes are set up better, you know. Anyway, the other great battle in this race was between Carol Abraham and Cal Crutchlow, who were going for the Rookie of the Year in MotoGP.
Sure.
And they were together the entire time, back and forth. And unfortunately, Carol Abraham ran off and crashed and still remounted and finished in eighth. Cal Crutchlow actually caught Danny Pedrosa and passed him, so he finished fourth, and that gave him the Rookie of the Year.
We should point out once again, an upside-down race. You've got Abraham and Crutchlow hounding Pedrosa, and Abraham crashes out in fourth. I mean,
yeah,
that's a bit of a shocker. Even just, you know, mentioning a lot of those guys in the same name, considering where they'd been running earlier in the race. But I mean, you know, that turn one incident. Just, you know, including the fact that four of the top guys, or four of the guys that were probably threatening for the podium in the conditions, were
at
gone.
At least one of those guys would have been up there.
Yeah, certainly made a real big difference. So, that whole thing, you know, I would have loved to see them in there still and see what happened, but it still made the whole thing for a very interesting little tableau of drama as it went on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
Way behind Danny Pedrosa, but in sixth was Katsuyuki Nakasuga, followed by Josh Hayes in seventh.
Indeed.
And I have to bring this up because you predicted that Josh was going to be 11th. And I was like poo-pooing you. I was like, nah, I mean, how many people are going to have to crash? Well, apparently four. But he finished seventh, which means if those guys hadn't crashed, he probably would have been 11th. It's pretty freaking great. Amazing, amazing ride by Josh Hayes.
I occasionally get one right, Jules.
Loris Caporossi, Tony Elias, Hector Barbera, Hiroshi Ayama, they've been there the entire year. Some of these guys have been racing a long time in GPs.
Sure.
Loris Caporossi's last race, obviously. I don't think Loris left the track. I don't think Elias left the track. I think Hector Barbera did. And I think Hiroshi Ayama got caught up in that first turn incident. But Josh Hayes beat some of those guys straight up, you know?
Sure. Sure.
I mean, that is really, really something.
Yep.
I think he probably would have had trouble if it was a really dry, warm race. Against those guys, but man, so psyched for him.
Unless four guys went out in the first corner.
Right.
So stoked
for that guy. So stoked. So cool. He's a really super nice guy, an incredible competitor.
No doubt. And frankly, considering the whole situation, he was originally scheduled to do a test And then they pulled him in for the race. And
Right.
And as it turned out, he didn't test the Thau. We were kind of hoping he was going to. His wife Melissa got to test the 800, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. She got to ride it around.
Yeah. But good on you, Josh. Very, very fucking cool.
I like what Ben Spee said about the last corner. He said, when we came out of the last corner, I got the paint sucked off the bike by Casey as he went past.
Yep.
Yeah, so good humor still.
I was actually chuckling during, I was watching FP2. I think it was FP2 from Eurosport. Mm-hmm. And Chaz Davis was in the booth. And Chaz basically roomed with Josh Hayes for a year, and that was when we did that silly garage band thing, a whole bunch of other stuff with those guys. But there were some good personal conversations. Those of you that might not have watched your recording of FP2 from Eurosport, you might want to go back and watch it again. It was there was some good conversation in there.
Cool.
Yeah.
Let's see what else we gotta talk about. Let's we had the awards ceremony, which is at the traditional kind of like Academy Awards style.
Before you go there, and I know we just touched on it just for a moment, but certainly a doff of the Motopod cap, and for a massively long and illustrious career, as well as wearing the number 58 for Loris Capirossi. Loris, you will be missed. You have provided an awful lot of cool racing over the years, very interesting things to watch, some controversial, many, many not. And it was great to see your family overjoyed at your finish, and going to be sad to see you go. 41% of MotoGP, of premier class races, Loris ran in, dude.
That's right. Yeah. I had the statistic. Yeah, well, if we're going to go through that kind of stuff, I was actually going to think about saving that to the end, but that was also the last 125 race, and congratulations to Nicolas Tirole for, you know, he's the last 125 cc champion, last two-stroke champion for a while, I imagine.
Sure.
Congrats to Danny Webb, who was the last, you know, 125 on pole.
Mm-hmm.
And by far, I think the most important thing to mention about the weekend was that, you know, after warm up we had the Marco Simoncelli tribute lap.
Oh, sure.
Which was incredible because every single bike went out there, and you know, there was a lot of talk about it. They're going to rev the bikes for a little bit, and then I mean logistically this was such a hard thing to pull off, so hats off to everybody involved, Valencia staff and Dorna and FIM for allowing this. But every single bike went out on track. The MotoGP bikes lined up with Kevin Schwantz riding Marcus Grissini into a special spot right before the finish line. All the bikes parked at the finish line, and I mean right past the finish line, and then all the MotoGP bikes parked in a single row at the finish line, and then a gaggle of 125s and Moto2 behind them. And they had a huge firework display at that point, which is, I thought it was a fantastic send off for Simoncelli.
Yeah, no doubt, and very, very, very appropriate. I don't know about you,
very
Jules,
appropriate.
But when I was watching that lap with all of those bikes on course, I was kind of holding my breath a little bit.
Yeah, I know.
I'm like, okay, we got 125, 600 Moto2 bikes, and all of the MotoGP guys. And you could, when they had a lot of on bike stuff when they were going around, everybody's kind of looking around real cautiously, like, you know, going into corners.
Yeah. Talk about different lines right there. Guys carrying flags, some guys wearing special shirts. I mean, it was incredible. It's an incredible sight.
That's a lot of race bikes and testosterone to all have on the track at the same time. Although I believe there was a single female out there on an Aspar bike this weekend.
What's her name?
Yeah, Reyes something. Yeah.
Great. We forgot her name again.
She was a governing factor, apparently.
Yeah, and then they had that giant banner that went up the tower.
Yeah.
So, yeah, very, very, very beautiful tribute. And the proper way to honor Marco Simoncelli, and then also with the race that we just talked about, because it was a damn good race, damn good spectacle. The Simoncelli tribute is available for free on MotoGP.com, so even if you don't have a subscription, you should go check it out. In fact, we'll link to it in the show notes, so you can go check that out if you haven't seen it yet.
Cool.
Silly season. So, we know that Barbara has signed to Pramac. This is now official. We know that Alvaro Bautista is going to Gresini.
Right.
As of this morning, it's now official. What's really strange is that during the test, we saw... David Emmett, I think, was the first one that I heard this from, but I still was like, really? Was that Randy DiPugna was going to ride the Suzuki 800 at the test, and he did. He did ride it, although only on Tuesday. He did not show up on Wednesday. The team had packed up by that point. And but he did. You know, there's no word about where Randy's going.
And there's no real word about where what Suzuki is doing.
And that's the big thing. I think that we were still talking about Bautista, you know, holding out for the Suzuki ride. But I think he at one point was like the red flags went out when Suzuki said that if they race in 2012, they will be racing the 800 until at least Brno. So half the season, more than half the season, I think, is on. Still going to be on the 800s, and then they may bring in a 1,000cc bike. So, with all those question marks and red flags, I think Bautista was like, "No way! I've got other offers. I'm going." And so he's going to Team Gresini, which I believe is going to only run one bike.
That's my understanding too. Your notes here, or the notes here, say that, and it's still being Wednesday. That Suzuki was testing. I didn't notice who was testing Suzuki today.
Oh yeah, my notes are wrong. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. So the biggest surprise was that Stefan Bradl, who was going to get a ride on the Moto2 bike, MotoGP bike, kind of as a quote unquote reward. It looks very, very likely. Extremely likely. In fact, by the time you listen to the show, you may have already heard that he will be signing up with LCR for MotoGP.
Yep.
Now, I may have to cut this part out, but I want to ask you, Jim, because you have talked to Lucio Cecinelli both on and off the record, but was there some kind of falling out with Randy DiPugna and LCR?
Yeah, it was just a disagreement because Randy was playing his cards close to his vest, trying to pick up a few more bucks. And in the end,
at the end of last season, you mean?
Yeah, in the end, you know, LCR didn't have it, and Randy took it in the kisser and ended up going to Pramac, which was not his best bet. But you know,
the reason why I'm asking is because everybody is, and myself included, are saying, you know, Randy DiPugna had probably his best year in MotoGP last year with the LCR Honda. Why wouldn't they want him back? Obviously, there's you know, obviously it wasn't the results that didn't bring him back.
Right, but if you're pressing for money on a team that's already hard pressed for money.
I totally understand. I'm just saying that without that little bit of information, I wasn't sure what it was, what kind of terms they left on. I just remember hearing that it wasn't good terms, and I wasn't sure whether it was some disagreement throughout the season or was it simply contractual, you know, kind of games that riders and their agents and stuff play.
I'm sure it was, and well beyond what I have been told, or and certainly probably, but what I could relate out. But that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. I mean, you hear an awful lot of stuff around the paddock, and in the limited amount of time that we spend there. Although I have spent, you're right, I've spent a lot of time talking to the guys at LCR.
That's why I was asking.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to the test then. Hondas dominated with Danny Pedrosa actually on top over Casey Stoner. But both those guys said that they were nowhere near the potential of the bike still. I don't know what nowhere near means, because they were setting lap times about the same as than when they were out in the 800s. And it was, of course, better weather. So
I can tell you exactly what it means. It means,
exactly. But because both of them had different kinds of complaints about, you know, chatter, which is mm-hmm. partly due to the new Bridgestone tires, which are softer, and you know, some kind of strange power delivery issues and whatever. It doesn't matter, because they were very fast.
Yeah.
Ben Spies was the only one that got in within a second of them, and he was very happy with the M1. Let's see, who else was there? We had Cal Crutchlow and Andrea Dovizioso circulating. Cal actually also got within a second of Pedrosa. But Andrea Dovizioso was a further 0.7 back. Now, he's obviously getting used to the bike. This is not... The times here are probably the... This is the most dangerous kind of test to be looking at times and making any kind of predictions or anything like that. Except for the Hondas, of course. But because they're all working on very different things. I mean, Andrea Dovizioso was the first time on the Yamaha. He had some very interesting feedback. One of the most interesting things that he said was that the Yamaha tends to wheelie a lot. And that means that because we don't really see that. We don't really see that the front end wants to go up. I guess the riders have gotten used to it. But what it tells me is the Honda anti-wheelie system is really, really good.
Well, not to mention that your so-called seamless gearbox doesn't actually have the feel of gear changes between it, which in that little blip will actually bring the front.
Yeah. Right. Because he has a short shift with on the Yamaha. And of course Rossi was out there on the frame that Ducati was saying they weren't building, which is the what are they calling it now? They're not calling it twin spar. They're calling it
bike zero.
Yeah, no, that's what they're calling the bike, but they're calling the frame a perimeter frame.
Yeah, perimeter frame, and that's the name for it. I mean,
but remember, it was throughout the season they were saying twin spar. Well, whatever terminology, blah blah.
The terminology is actually key, because perimeter frame is an ancient term in motorcycle chassis design, going back, you know, to steel tube frames back in the 70s and 80s, the very tried and true design. The way that they're utilizing it, if you read what they're talking about now, is this: they're essentially trying to, and I do take issue with this, because I was looking at some of the photos, and there's clearly things that you can do, which Preziosi admitted in his talk on Monday. But Felipe Preziosi, the top dog at Ducati, mentioned on Monday was that it allows them to move the engine around in the frame and to get some ideas. But in the same vein, he also said, well, we're imitating our monocoque carbon fiber design with this chassis. Well, you kind of don't get it both ways. But that being said, whatever they need to do, I'm all for it. Clearly, 2012 was a testing year that didn't necessarily go to plan, but it's obvious they have some ideas, and the bikes didn't suck in testing.
Nope.
Yeah, and we've still got a long ways to go. You know, we're going to have the winter break, and as everybody said in all their post-test interviews, okay, we've given them the information, go make it better. Well, you know, there's still going to be a lot of input and a lot of things going on during the winter testing ban, which only tests the official riders from testing. These bikes are going to be spending a lot of time on the track, probably in southern locales.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Valentino Rossi had very different things to say about it than Hector Barbera. Hector Barbera said that immediately he felt that the bike was better. He actually said he felt a lot like his 250. Valentino Rossi said it felt exactly the same as before, still has the same problems, but he was saying that now that they have this frame that they can work off of, they'll have much more flexibility on weight distribution.
Was there a bit of a pun in that statement?
What do you mean?
A lot more flexibility in weight distribution.
Oh, yeah. And let's see, Bautista on the Grassini, Stefan Bradl obviously was out there on the LCR Honda. That's going to be really cool. I'm actually really looking forward to seeing this constant progression of Moto2 champion to MotoGP, if they can keep that up, you know?
Yeah.
And hopefully he'll do better than the previous Moto2 champion. Who is he definitely going to Superbikes now? Do we know?
Tony?
We don't know anything about Tony Elias.
I've heard some fairly persistent talk that he'll be back in Moto2 next year.
Really?
I can't remember which exact team it was with, but it sounded like it was relatively solid.
Wow.
And I'm sorry, I don't have a quote nor anything from
it's
that.
It's his class, man. It's his class. That's where he belongs. I think that's a great move.
I would love to see him and Marquez battle the shit out of each other next year. That would be cool.
Oh man.
The other thing that because he was as dominant, he was more dominant than Marquez was this year in his championship season. I mean, he Tony kicked ass. Backtracking a little bit, Jules, because this was in the notes, and I think it will be interesting to see how this pans out. We know that Bautista is going to Grassini. We've got a good, solid idea that Stefan Bradl is going to LCR. The question is, odds are that one of those teams, maybe both, may end up with a quote-unquote factory bike, factory-supported bike, whatever level they end up with. It will be interesting to see who ends up with that machine. I think a lot of that's going to be based...
But I have a feeling that there is not going to be a factory bike, because as we were talking about last week, at the beginning of the season, you're not going to have a massive difference between the satellite machines and the factory machines.
We've had these conversations before.
It's going to come down to the kind of support that they're going to get, right?
Well, sure.
You really think that Grassini, after, you know, a decade of being, you know, the Honda, you know, the other Honda team is gonna be overlooked for LCR? LCR is gonna get I mean, Bautista's coming into Grassini. Bautista's a really well-known variable. If they're going to have this factory contract, it's going to go to Grassini. I just don't see it going to LCR.
I see that too, and it's common knowledge that Bautista is a Nakamoto favorite, Shuhei Nakamoto, who is head of HRC development stuff, right? The question being is, might there not be two? Because at the same time that Honda was desperate to win the final 800cc championship, why would they not be, in the same vein, very much wanting to win the first 1000cc championship?
Of course, but don't they want to win every single one, every single year? I mean, it's not like they said, oh, you know what? This year we're really going to want to win. Let's put extra effort into it. They've been putting extra effort in it the entire time during the 800cc era. It finally came to fruition now.
I don't think you're getting my point. This is their cheapest opportunity.
No, I understand that they want to have more bikes that they can get data from, more different riders they can get data from, so they can develop the bike better. Which means they might be able to, you know, now that they've won the championship and they might be able to get that kind of support from Honda, the company, to support the HRC effort, you know, financially to run, you know, all of their bikes as factory bikes. I understand what you're saying. I mean, we'll see. It's to me, the whole factory thing is kind of lame. You know?
Okay. Well, let me back you up a bit, because
the other thing is that Brattle's a rookie in the class, and he shouldn't be going to a factory team. He should be going to a non-factory.
He's not, and the rule doesn't apply.
What's that?
Let me finish. The rule doesn't apply because he's not going to a factory team. It's a factory-supported team, just the same way that the CMO's bike was.
I understand that you could play all sorts of legal jargon kind of games with it. I'm just saying that this, in the spirit of that rule, he should be going to a true satellite team.
Fine.
that rule, by the way, that rule needs to go.
I think we've got all of the test stuff done.
Well, so Suzuki was out there, right?
Yeah.
And what I think, when we say Suzuki, we have to remember that this is the Team Suzuki, Team Rizla Suzuki, Paul Denning's crew, which went out there on Tuesday and tested the bike. It wasn't Suzuki factory going, let's go have a test. It was more like they just said, okay, fine, you know, do whatever you want to do. But it is up to the Suzuki factory the company to sponsor Suzuki racing team, right? So just because they're out there testing has absolutely, it's not a clue towards, you know, are they going to be racing next season?
Oh, yeah.
And once again, by the time that you listen to the show, this may be a resolve, because apparently either Dorner or the FIM, I'm not sure which, has put their foot down and said you have to make a decision on Friday, which is this Friday, 2 days from today. So for most of you, you'll know by the time you listen to the show, but Suzuki will, I think, is going to get forced to make a decision.
I think so too. I mean, they've already got their options open. And well, there are, if you think about it, there's still an option open that's being held open for quote unquote Rizla Suzuki if they remain in MotoGP, and there's an open seat on the Crescent Suzuki World Superbike team, as well as, although I don't think they'll be back there in BSB if there's still an option. So that's kind of the musical blue, baby blue chairs right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do want to see them come back. I think whoever's going to have to put up with riding an 800cc bike is going to, I don't know, maybe they'll make an interesting, fight with the CRTs. There is one interesting point to be made though. I was just thinking about this, on the train home today. The 800s and the 1000s have the exact same amount of fuel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Allowable. So, yes, in a test when you don't have necessarily a fuel limit, although I'm sure that they're testing with partitioning the fuel in a way where it would be like under race conditions. There's a law of thermodynamics at work here, right? I mean, there's only so much that you can do with the same amount of fuel. No matter how big your engine is, you're gonna use it all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, harken back to the dawn of MotoGP proper, and the four strokes didn't win every race after that.
What do you mean?
Well, we had two stroke wins that first year, at least one, maybe two. I think I can't remember exactly who it was, but
I see what you said. Yeah.
So you could see in a mixed year, with the teething pains of the thousands, an 800. In the CRTs in there, you could see an 800 certainly get a podium and maybe even a win if the circumstances were right.
Yeah. Yeah. The right track, the right conditions.
Sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, but Suzuki is the only one that's going to be running 800. And, we forgot to mention the fact that there were four CRT teams. I mean, I can't believe I just did that. CRT bikes.
Oops.
We actually had a couple of people write in that, please stop saying CRT teams. I'm the one who always does that. Sorry about that.
Yeah. You did it again. By quoting their email. We did. We had, I think the one that was kind of a standout was the FTR Kawasaki, but it was interesting. I was looking at the large photos of that bike, and there was a lot of it that actually reminded me of the Hayate in a way, but I noticed they were using Showa fork, Showa rear suspension. I think they had Lockhart AP calipers. It was one of those bikes that you're like, damn, that's gorgeous. And then you're kind of looking at the bits and you're going, well, yeah, okay, that's who can sponsor the bike. And that's what the teams need is to get kit to get on the track now. And of course, success, build sponsorship. But I thought it was pretty interesting. It's certainly beautiful looking bike. And everybody knows, and I'm assuming it's based off of the ZX10R engine, which I'm not sure exactly what the piston measurements are. This will be an interesting part of the year. We actually get to go back and look, okay, the 81 millimeters, how do they have to figure that out? If it was larger or smaller based upon what we do for, we might actually get very geeky on bore and stroke, in not too long from now when we understand more logistics. We had a BMW suitor out there, all sorts of, interesting bikes. They weren't necessarily the stars nor where people were paying the most attention, but and these are a lot of bikes that are going to be suffering from teething pains over the winter, and those guys aren't going to have as much money to test with, but their restrictions are far reduced, so who knows, dude?
I mean obviously next year is going to be very difficult for all the CRTs to go through that teething pain period, but when 2013 rolls around, it's going to be interesting to see just what the mix looks like. And kind of to go back to last week's, Espoleta's war topic, Casey Stoner actually came out and had a couple of things to say about the CRT rules. And he says that if the series goes away from prototypes, that he is not really interested in racing in such a series if it's not a prototype series, which actually made me think about something else that I heard him saying at it wasn't at the award ceremony. He was talking about how Simoncelli's crash at Sepang made him realize that And with his kid on in a way, it made him realize that there's more to life than racing, that's when you hear that kind of a thing, you start thinking, just how many more years is Casey Stoner really interested in? He's not the type of guy who like goes for, he's not going to go for to break records. He's going to be out there as long as he's having fun, as long as he's enjoying the racing. And then he's just going to stop. He may be another Freddie Spencer, where he's there for a few seasons. We'll never really be able to measure him against the other champions by points, but rather by we were there to see him do it, so we know. But in the record books, he may end up, having the two championships, maybe three. Well, actually, three would be fantastic. And then, he rides off into the sunset with his beautiful wife and kid.
Yeah, he is going to end up with a second and a half penalty next year with the kid. That's a well-known racing fact.
That's right. So I have a feeling that does not apply to Stoner.
Well, you never know. You never know. But then I think Casey also made mention that he was going to be glowing if he went to Japan. So, who knows where these remarks are coming
from.
Right. We will have to see. And making any judgments on what's going to happen even based on the beginning of next year, much like Moto2, give the thing a year to tease out and give, let's see what Carmelo actually comes up with and Erda and Dornick actually comes up with for 2013, because you're literally 2012 is the cover of what will be the book of CRT/Moto1. Have they started calling it Moto1 yet? I thought that was going to be the name.
No, not yet.
Has that drifted off into nothingness? Because,
well, I think that the factors would be very upset if they got put into the same umbrella as the CRT. But be covered by different rules, you know?
Yeah. Hmm.
So if you call the championship Moto 1, I think the factors would be upset. I think the it's important for them to be shown as factory effort.
It would be interesting. Yeah, very interesting. I'm actually looking forward to seeing how, because I'm pretty sure, and I think I say this every year, as we wander into this time of year, is that the rules that we have set now are not going to be the rules that we end up with 3 months into the season, 6 months into the season. And I think they're going to morph as we go along and it's, you know, Espeleta has even said that, you know, if the CRTs need more fuel, we'll give them more fuel. I kind of like that flexibility as long as it stays within a logical limit. And
as long as it does, they don't chase the results.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. A logical limit where you're not trying to, because what you can end up doing is over chasing and then everything just becomes artificial. So,
yeah, it's like maybe it was 3 years ago when the Ducati Superbike and Superbikes kept adding the weights, you know?
Yeah. I wasn't going to go there, but that thought was in the very forefront of my mind. So we'll have to see how it works out.
All right. So a couple of, administrative things. So we're going to have one more show after this one next week, and then we're going to take a little bit of break. So we'll be back sometime in December after that, and that'll be for show 300, which will be a good one.
With fireworks and everything.
Yeah, with fireworks and everything. And then again, we'll be taking another break at the end of December. A lot of people are obviously going to be away. We'll come back in the new year. So there's probably going to be, after next week's show, there might be two more shows this year. So if you want any questions answered before January, write in now. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that we've been kind of striving to make the shows come out on Wednesdays. But we're going to start to be a little bit looser about that, so that we don't have to keep going to Facebook and saying, hey, the show's going to be late this week. Like, we're recording this call on Wednesday because we decided that it'd be better if we actually cover the testing, all of the testing. And so the call yesterday wouldn't have made much sense. And plus we have, you know, real life to attend to. So there's always, sometimes we could do a call on Monday, sometimes that we can't do a call until much later in the week. So we're just going to make sure that the show is out by Friday, basically. And that's what we commit to.
We have now declared that there is no such thing as late.
Yes, exactly. Because Paul Manson, you know what I'm talking about. Anyway, so you just mentioned actually, yeah, we also started the Google Plus page as an experiment. We'll see how that goes. We'll have that in the show notes as well. That's it for the administrative stuff. So let's do the goodbye stuff.
Yeah, I can do that.
All right.
Bye.
Good night, everyone. Thanks for listening. And we'll talk to you next week.
We will. We have to. Next week, we're going to have to go. And we'll talk to you later.
Sometime in December. Maybe. All right.
Thanks, Joel. Take care, Joe. Ciao, everybody.
Yeah.
We are very happy to finally finish the last test and look forward to having a little bit of a break. You know, the test's gone quite well for us. The first day we tested most of the things we needed to, and the second day we just needed to try a few things like different front and rear tyre pressures to understand if we can reduce the chattering problem that we had from yesterday. And just understand a new brake caliper from Brembo and a couple of other small things. But in general, we got everything done that we needed to. We did, you know, as little laps as possible just to get this done. And, you know, we can now start preparing ourselves for next season. But, you know, we're pretty happy with the way the test went and everything that we managed to get done today.
What just happened?
I opened a beer.